Welcome to the BMT Sustainability Podcast with me, Del Redvers, Sustainability Director at BMT.
And me, Laura Blake. As Head of Sustainability, I've supported BMT's sustainability agenda for 7 years and have dedicated my career to driving sustainable development and responsible business practices.
We have a shared interest in the complexity of shaping a better world. And together, this is our first experience of delivering a podcast.
We're super excited to give this a go and hugely appreciate you being with us on this journey, exploring the diverse and dynamic world of sustainability as we work to deliver purpose-led change.
Our world is full of complex and interconnected challenges, where it isn't always possible to reduce ideas to a single soundbite or statistic, and often where there isn't an objectively right or wrong answer. We want to talk to people across our business to get their ideas on sustainability-related topics, and in doing so, to improve our thinking as a business.
This podcast is our attempt to do just that. In each episode, we will explore different ways of looking at a wide range of challenging topics, prompting us to think critically and stay open to change.
So, thank you for listening, and let's get started.
Welcome to the final episode of Series 1 of The Purpose Effect. Over the series, we've been exploring complex challenges shaping our world, and we've attempted to ask better questions and strive for bolder conversations with insights from our employees. To round the series off, we are really pleased to be joined by our CEO, Sarah Kenny. Sarah, we're delighted you could join us. We're excited, and I'm sure some of our listeners are too, to hear some of your reflections on the ideas that we've been exploring.
Thank you, Del and Laura.
Hello. And yes, we've had so much good conversation across this series of podcasts. There's a lot to reflect on. Now, we've only got time to touch on a few of the ideas today. So if anyone listening hasn't heard the previous 6 episodes, please do go and check them out. But to get us into today's conversation, it would be great to have a bit of your big picture perspective, Sarah. You were interviewed recently on an external podcast, and you were asked if you could fix just one thing in the world, what would it be? And of the thousands of things in the world you could have picked, you said climate change. Why?
So you're right, there's a huge number of issues you could pick. But actually, it's kind of stepping back and understanding that our climate is something that can't be taken for granted. And all of the massive systems and ecosystems and animal life cycles, plant life cycles that depend on our climate get it wrong, and it almost everything else is sort of pointless. It kind of hinges off of it. So if the it's a bit, in the same interview I spoke about why I went into ocean science, and fundamentally the importance of the oceans to our climate, our food chains, our weather, access to water is completely determined by the ocean. And so our understanding of the ocean is incredibly poor. I think we probably know more about the moon than we do the sea. So, that feels counterintuitive to me. And so why climate? Why the climate? Because it drives everything else. It drives access to food, it drives access to water, it drives livability in a particular habitat, country, part of the world. It drives... it's fundamental to our existence. And so if we allow the climate to be intentionally or perhaps even unintentionally damaged, then that feels like a rather self-defeating thing to me. So, you can look at things like conflict, you can look at things like famine. Actually, when you peel back the layers and you work out what's really going on, what caused those events, a lot of it's actually to do with access to food, resources, whatever it is. So competition for resources is going to get stronger, not weaker, as the climate changes and continues to change. We're watching mass migration out of parts of Africa at the moment. Why? Because actually climate change is underneath a lot of the economic damage that's being done in those parts of the world. So I guess it's perhaps a rather utopian view, but you fix the climate, you fix a whole load of other issues that, to my mind, are symptomatic of climate change rather than things that could be addressed on their own.
So you're saying that you see like a massive, complex system challenge of all these interconnected problems, but right in the middle of it, there's climate, which has got tentacles into everything. Probably mixing metaphors. Climate doesn't have tentacles. But anyway,
it can.
It's a giant octopus. And it has tentacles, or maybe squid, because they've got two more tentacles. Have they got two more tentacles than octopus?
Oh, no, I don't know.
Anyway. It's sitting there in the middle of all of this stuff. I think that's a really good way of looking at it. And being a bit more forthright, because, I mean, it's only us, right? And this isn't going out into the real world out there outside. What's your assessment of the way we collectively as a species are dealing with the climate crisis?
That's a huge question. What's my assessment of the way as a species, humans collective?
Like right now, do you think we're doing, like we're getting there? Yeah. Like, or are we miles off?
It's mostly inadequate. And, you know, if it wasn't, we wouldn't be facing some of the, you know, the repeated climatic incidences that you see happening and unfurling all over the world every single day in the news, and then the whole load of things that never make it to the news. So is it... I mean, there's a bigger philosophical question as well about who can change things and who can't change things, mm. who should change things, and, you know, should rich countries do more because they have the capital to support change programs? Should we be allowing poorer countries to go through? You often hear... The sort of narrative of, well, you know, you had your turn during the Industrial Revolution for those who, you know, who were sort of more prosperous economies at the time of the Industrial Revolution. So now it's our turn. And actually, you know, so you need to let us build, you know, coal power stations and blast furnaces because you had your go 100 years ago. That feels rather self-defeating to me. So I think it, to the extent that you can say that the human race is a species that has alignment because it's one species, are we doing enough? No, of course not. But there's a whole load of stuff underneath that of who should do things, who can do things, what material changes can we make? And then, of course, each of us as members of our nation states, societies, or communities, whatever it is, you could argue perhaps it doesn't matter who you are or where you live. All of us can make a difference, but that's a choice, a conscious choice.
Yeah, so are you saying that basically the reason that argument about, well, it should be our turn to have a go at burning some coal is we've all got the same objective, which is to try and decarbonise the global economy. So it kind of doesn't, you know, we all have to play a part. The world is presented to us as it is today in that regard. Yeah. I like your point about... being thoughtful about what we can do and who can do something, and maybe those who can act should act in whatever, wherever that capacity sits. How does that shape your view of what BMT does or should do?
Well, I guess for a start, it does shape my view of what BMT should do. And there's a connection here to who we are as a company and the values and the culture and the behaviours of the company and the things that our customers value in what we do, which actually come out quite strongly through the values. And when I talk to our customers and ask them what they value about BMT, virtually every time the first word that comes out of their mouth isn't, oh, this technical thing that they did for me, it's trust, it's integrity. Is that a belief that we will do the right thing for the customer, and the customers believe in us because of that. That's really quite special. And I think it's unusual, and it distinguishes us from many, if not all, of our competitors, actually. And with it comes, to my mind, a responsibility, and the responsibility is to make sure that that what the company does lives up to that. So we can't do things that run counter to trust and integrity. We have to make sure that that's first and foremost in the minds of all of our people, and the things that they say and the way that they conduct themselves and the way that the company presents itself to the market and the things we invest in and the way we think about our strategy and our future.
So I think that makes complete sense. And I would argue that that trust, you build that trust by people seeing consistency in how you approach the world, essentially. If people can see, you know, they understand your motivation, they can see how you're consistent in the way you approach the world, there's something to trust, essentially, at the heart of it. And in a world where we're seeing now very different, very polarised views of quite big issues, even between the governments of our home nations, let alone between customers in different market segments or even our own employees, how do we hold a course through there that enables everyone to trust us when we have to take issues on some of this stuff? We have to take a position on some of these things, and the world around us is trying to politicise a lot of these issues, like diversity and climate change. How do we chart a course through that?
Well, I suppose the simple answer is carefully, but using the strategy, the values, you know, what we know to be at the heart of the culture of the company as a handrail in everything we do. So when we confront a decision, seabed mining, the classic one, when you confront a decision like, should we be involved in seabed mining, you go back to the strategy, you go back to the values, you go, you know, it, actually what's consistent with all of those things, which is why those things are important. They're not just things that exist on PowerPoint slides that we show to the board once a year, or maybe I've noticed I was in one of the offices a couple of weeks ago, it was on the back of the toilet door, classic, I love that. So if you're sitting on the loo and looking at the strategy, that's fine with me, that's good. If that's but you know, why does that matter? Because that's the stuff we're living, and it has to be, like I say, it's not just shelfware, it's not something that's used in a presentation and forgotten about. It's who we are, it's what we stand for. And we use that, and we have used it, actually, very overtly when we've had to make a difficult decision. We've gone back and said, what does the strategy tell us?
Absolutely. And one of the things that we had fed back to us came out in the conversation on one of the podcasts we did with the EEG representatives about how BNT listens to its employees. That they were really pleased to work for a company that was thoughtful about these things and went back to stuff like values and took the time to reflect and try and make a good decision, you know, noting that no decision could ever be objectively right. It's just, you know, trying to make the best decision under the circumstances isn't something that everybody, every company would necessarily do. And I think it takes time and commitment to do that, I would argue. We've got into like some really light stuff then to get this conversation going. The nature of humanity, the climate crisis, and how to fix it all, and how to fix it all in the company.
But what we really wanted to do with this episode, to round off our first series of this podcast, was to reflect on some of the themes that have come out of the other episodes, and I guess to get your take on them, Sarah.
Where do you think we should go next, Laura?
The episode that seemed to resonate the most with our listeners was the conversation that we had with Gudrun about meritocracy. And it was about the idea of rewarding personal achievement in an unequal society where not everyone has the same opportunity to succeed. And we were really heartened because several of our listeners got in touch to share their personal stories, and either about how lucky they had been to have had opportunity that others might not have had, or how much harder it was for them growing up and pursuing their careers and having to push because of the lack of opportunity.
You weren't exactly born with a silver spoon in your mouth and sent to the very finest of public schools for the most expensive education money could buy. And as far as I know, there's no aristocracy in your immediate family.
My mum thinks she's the queen, if that. But it's just her perception.
Well, they stop her at Buckingham Palace when she tries to go in. By any measure, you haven't had the sort of massive boot up, as in not the boot up, I mean the elevation that you know, that some people might have. And also, yet by any definition, you could argue that you have achieved success. You know, you're the CEO of a company, You're respected in the industry. You get invited to be all sorts of advisors and on, an advisor and sit on different panels and chair things and all sorts of stuff, which has come about on the basis of merit. If you can do that, and I'm not criticising you or saying there's anything wrong with you, but if you can do that from a very normal background, why can't others do it? And why do we need initiatives to encourage women in the business and in STEM?
As an organisation, where this starts to become quite more challenging, in other words, we have to be decisive, is when you get into issues like DE&I and representation of whoever, whether it's ethnic minorities or females or whatever in the workplace. And, you know, we have deliberately not gone into quotas, for example. What we've focused on in our DE&I initiatives is more about how we deliver equity and equality, and trying to drive an inclusive working environment on the basis that if every experience anyone has when they come into BMT is the same, it's the same high quality, and that no one feels that they're, because of their race, their gender, their beliefs, that somehow that they're not equal, then to me, dealing with the inclusion and equity side of it is far more important than saying we're going to have 30% women, so we're not going to hire any men this year. You know, that, because that, to me, is just as divisive as accidentally hiring all men because you haven't put anything in place to change that. So I'm much more into creating an environment where people just don't think about this stuff. You know, once we have succeeded, and we will succeed, we won't be thinking about it anymore. We won't need to put it in people's objectives. Our people team won't need to be running initiatives on it because it will just happen. And, you know, that to me is what good looks like. Good looks like not worrying about it because it's happened. At the moment, we aren't there. We have made a lot of progress. And in many respects, we're better than our peer companies. And we're certainly better than the, you know, bearing in mind a lot of what we do, not everything is in the marine and maritime sector. We're leagues and leagues and light years actually ahead of the marine and maritime sector. So that's great. And we should actually celebrate that probably more than we do, but not use that as a reason not to focus on continuous change and continuous improvement. And, you know, bottom line up front, you know, can anyone get to where I am? Yes, of course, because I did, right? So therefore it's possible. But does that mean we shouldn't be developing people, coaching people, training people, you know, making sure that everyone can realise their potential? No, you know, you need to be active in these things, not passive. And that's as much a responsibility on the individual as it is on the organisation, which is why that, you know, the importance of creating that inclusive environment, but also good line managers who understand the different and individual needs of the people who work for them and work on their development and play to their strengths, and the individual taking ownership of that and driving it. So why am I here? Because you mentioned it earlier, I had a lot of really good luck with line managers, and it was luck, and so, especially given some of the people I've worked with in the past who are less than desirable line management techniques, but I was blessed. I had really, really good line managers and people who didn't necessarily give me an easy time, were quite challenging, but made me better because of it. You know, I wanted to be better. So, you know, what does that mean for us? It means our line managers have got to be the best they possibly can be. Our people have got to take responsibility for their own development, and the organisation's got to create an inclusive environment that allows them to do it.
So do you feel, that's really interesting, do you feel that earlier in your career, had you maybe not encountered some of those really positive influences in line managers, or had you been exposed to really rubbish line managers on a consistent basis, your career could have taken a different path?
Who knows is the answer to that. There's something about me that not everybody, yeah, I'm not saying it's a good thing necessarily, but I don't mind challenging things. So, and that's always been the case. So if I have had some poor line managers in the past, I've been blessed that overall they've been on the positive, but you know, I've stopped working for them and gone and done something else. And so
And that's my point about individual ownership. You know, you can get yourself stuck in a rut, and you need to get yourself out of it. Laura was actually at a speech I gave at a lunch a few weeks ago, and one of the closing remarks I gave, because it was about women in the marine and maritime sector, was all of us suffer with imposter syndrome and you just have to deal with it. And if you can't deal with it for yourself, deal with it on the basis that if you don't deal with it, how can you expect other people to? And if you're not dealing with it and you feel inadequate and you're giving off all that negative energy, why would anyone want to come and work in the sector? So do it for other people, even if you can't do it for yourself. And it's not about saying I haven't got imposter syndrome anymore. It's just about saying, yeah, we've all got it. It's horrible, isn't it? Put it out of the way and just forget it. So it's that collective responsibility, I suppose.
I think something I'm quite interested in, I think it's amazing. It's what keeps PPNT, the culture and the diversity in the workforce that we're building.
And the quality of your line manager.
Yes, obviously, exactly.
So just building on that, I'd like to explore this a bit further. So we've talked a lot about creating the right systems, having the right processes, making sure we have an inclusive environment when people join us. And that's clearly really important. In the episode with Gudrun, we also thought about what responsibility we have to reach people who might never have had the chance to pursue a STEM-based career, whether that's because of a shortage of guidance, a shortage of opportunity or access. So I think it's really, you know, if we're really serious about diversity, it can't just be about the people already within or close to our network. So the question for you, Sarah, is how far should our responsibility extend in actively reaching those who are furthest away from these opportunities and making sure that those in our societies aren't left behind?
Good. It's a really good question, and there's something about scale and impact as well in there, on the basis that, you know, as a 200 million turnover company with 1400 employees spread all over the world, you know, that there's something about we could do a lot of little things in a lot of places and could potentially be accused of tokenism, actually, because the impact that we can have because of our geography, because we're relatively small, you know, would that be a reason not to try? So I'm quite proud of the work that we do. You mentioned STEM, but, you know, all across the geography of BMT, we have people who are the equivalent of STEM ambassadors all over the world, who are out doing things in communities, they're out doing things in schools. We've got an awful lot of people volunteering. I wish we captured it better than we do, not because they're not just BMT people doing BMT things, like the fantastic team that just did the 24 Peaks Challenge in the Lake District for the Seafarers Charity. That's brilliant. That's totemic. You know, really obvious. You can put it on your website. But how many of our people in their private lives are volunteers for the Scouts, for example? Don't really know is the answer to that. Or sit on the board of charities. Don't really know. And there's something about our culture that I think means that intuitively we probably do a lot more of that even in our private lives than we recognise that we do. So I think there's something about the culture of our organisation that means that we're probably delivering quite a high impact as it is.
I actually agree with you. I went out and did some interviews with middle managers within the business, and that was one of the questions, looking at how many people volunteered aside the day-to-day. And it was outstanding, the amount of people that,
yeah,
quite inspiring, the amount of people that volunteered but didn't really categorise it as volunteering, saw it as something that they like doing as part of their everyday lives. So I imagine our impact extends beyond what we realise sometimes because of who we employ and the culture that we drive.
I think the tokenism point is really important as well, because it can really look like tokenism when small companies or individuals, you know, when we try and take actions in our own lives to do stuff, and you know that it amounts to almost nothing in the grand scheme of things, and you know it won't have any impact on any measurable outcome anywhere, but you can't not do it, because if you don't do it, then who on earth do you expect to do it?
Yeah.
And it's you often talk about earning the right, don't you, about... you know, it's sort of a walking the talk thing, that if you don't do it, you have to earn the right. And I guess you're saying the same in this space.
Yeah, yeah, pretty well. And there's the question, I haven't actually answered Laura's question because it just feels a little bit big and complicated insofar that let me think of it a different way. So if we were a company of 30,000 people and a couple of billion of turnover, would this be an easier question to answer?
I think probably not. And it's quite a deep response, but we've had conversations about this quite a lot, that just because you have a lot of money, it doesn't necessarily mean you have the right intention. So, and you might say that with more money and more profit that you're going to donate more money to charity, but ultimately you might just put more within profit distribution for your employees or your shareholders because that's where your values lie. So I don't think more money necessarily means more difference and more impact.
It could also mean more inertia, and you have to take the entirety of a, whatever it is, a 30,000 employee, multi-billion pound business, and then you see how that doesn't work, trying to change direction. And, BP is a really good example that's tried to change direction and then failed and tried to change direction again and is really struggling to find its identity as a behemoth of a company. I mean, you don't get much bigger than that, and struggling to solve these problems, not because there's a lack of will necessarily to solve the problem, but it's not easy to have, I guess, the agility that we might have.
Also, I think there's this, I think the fact that if you're a much larger organisation, there's so many more layers. Our management team here, our executive team, yourself, you're working amongst employees every day, you're engaging with customers and you're engaging with communities, whereas much larger organisations, I imagine the executive and the board of directors don't have that same potential communication avenues and streams to their communities and their customers as we do.
A small group of us went up to visit BAE Systems in Glasgow a few weeks ago to look at the Type 26 in build and have a conversation with them about what they're doing up there. Now, they have invested both in Glasgow and in Barrow and Furness, where they build the submarines, in academies. And they are taking local children directly out of school and running them through apprenticeships in all sorts of different disciplines, everything from welding all the way through to project management and selling and business development. So, and they've set these academies up. And in Barrow and Furness in particular, which is an area of well-understood economic deprivation, it's making a massive, massive difference to the perception of employment, the perception of a career and jobs. And they've got, a rapidly growing population to support the blooming submarine programme. But it's changing the nature of Barrow and Furness for the positive. So crime's going down, educational achievement's going up, average earnings is going up. Now, in terms of the social value that is delivering, it's excellent. It would tick every box. It is also self-interest to BAE Systems because they need something like 700,000 people over the next less than 10 years to support the programmes that they're working on in the defence industry. So, yes, it's a massive investment and it's delivering huge social value that hopefully will endure because educational attainment tends to lift everything. So isn't that great? So there's something about... That's why I asked you the question about does scale matter? Because scale, in some respects, if it's used for the good, even if it's actually ultimately a self-interest, the good it's doing is still good. And so there's something about organisations needing to think through... I think it's the right thing to think through... How can we, as maybe something we're bidding or something we're delivering or a future proposal where we might say, well, could we put that capability with that one, partner with that company and create something else of social value that, by the way, actually helps us to deliver that?
Yeah.
So I actually think that's a good model
for how to make it work. And you know, you could be really cynical about it and say, well, they're only doing that because they need welders. Yeah, and it's still making a positive difference.
And I know, Sarah, because we talk about this quite often. Like, well, quite often we have a chat, we end up being some really ridiculous, like, nature of the universe kind of thing. And I know that you're, in a very literal sense, quite thoughtful about big issues. You know, it doesn't sort of pass you by. And you've been talking here in this conversation about the responsibility of businesses. And to try and draw a couple of those themes together, how then do you see your responsibility as a CEO of this company? Not sort of in theory, but in practice, you're CEO of this company. What's your responsibility to kind of help influence things positively?
Ultimately, in my tenure as the CEO, I'm responsible and accountable for everything that goes on now. But more importantly, I'm responsible and accountable for the legacy and the positive legacy that I want to leave, the rest of the executive committee want to leave, is one where the company goes from strength to strength, and with it, the good that we do goes from strength to strength. That you know, customers continue to value us for our trust and integrity, but also we can point to the things that we've done that made a difference. Not because we want to crow about it, but because they have made a difference. And so if there's something I'd like us to all spend more time doing, it's thinking about how we use our business, even though it's relatively small and really geographically dispersed, to do some things that maybe are totemic, but they're totemic because they genuinely are making a difference.
So using the business in a way that genuinely benefits communities whilst supporting what we do. And just building on that and reflecting on a point you made earlier on, I think you made an interesting point about self-interest being okay. And I think the BAE Academy is a really good example. They're building a workforce for the future whilst uplifting society, investing in skills and opportunity. I think there's another crucial lens there just to round off this point. And I think the key's also about tying it back to purpose. So making sure that initiative remains the priority, you know, and not sidelined when priorities change or profits change. And I don't think it will in the example given, but in the case of BAE, making sure that once they've hit their recruitment targets, also that programme endures beyond the 10 years because it's part of their values, not just because it was a business need or requirement at the time.
Actually, having really good relationships with charities where you can do things collaboratively with them rather than just throw money at them, I think that's really important as well. So I'd rather have a few strategic relationships with charities where we are embedded in their plans and likewise them, you know, the other way around. And we can work on joint projects and not just send them $5,000 a year and how you keep our fingers crossed that it's gone somewhere good and read the annual report at the end and go, oh, no idea whether our $5,000 made any difference there or not. Yeah. So, you know, that to me is quite important.
Yeah. I think the one thing I would, not challenging you on, but come at a different angle on is the fact that I think actually not having that same amount of money to invest in social value initiatives is at the moment making us think differently about how we actually drive that impact. And if anything, it's driving us to want to partner with people more, and it's probably opening up the doorway more. So I'd say it's actually breaking down barriers and getting us to think more holistically about the problem and how we solve something than having the money to set up something like an academy.
It's just a function of human nature that if you make life difficult, people either give up or find a creative way of dealing with it. And, you know, I would say it's lucky that having a limited pot of money actually for you acts as a challenge to go and be innovative, because it quite easily could just go, oh, I haven't got enough, I won't bother. So that, you know, that it's an observation of our culture, actually. wouldn't it be nice if you had a pot of money that you were actually more comfortable with and you were innovative about how you used it? Because that to me is where we start to get real value.
Yeah.
I think an interesting thread here is also about ambition of outcome. You know, I think BMT certainly over more recent years has become much more ambitious about the outcomes that, you know, collectively we want to achieve in the world, both through delivering our purpose, but also, you know, and to get there through the things we do for our customers in terms of the scale of the problems we can solve and the things we can bite off. And to the point about investing in social value, I think we're really ambitious about the outcomes we can achieve in society with relatively little resource compared to the very large companies. So that takes us through the meritocracy argument in many, many different ways. And thank you for bringing your views to that, Sarah. We had some other points of conversation in the podcast series. Where else, Laura?
Yeah, so I think it brings us nicely on to our discussion that we had with Monty. Again, it's using your influence, thinking about how you have much bigger influence as an organisation. So we were talking about, as an organisation, when should we lead with our customers versus when should we follow in terms of delivering on our purpose and being more impactful. We've touched on customer intimacy already and what it means to lead purpose-driven change. Now, thinking about your career, you've often reflected on times where you've pushed for better outcomes, but what gave you the courage to take that lead when the customer wasn't quite ready to follow?
The simple answer is belief, actually. And this is a hard one to say without sounding arrogant. And you've got to apply a filter or use people you trust to apply a filter to you around whether you're being arrogant or belligerent or actually you're on the right path. You know, I've had in the course of my career some moments which have been incredibly challenging when customers or communities of customers who I have absolute faith in and enjoyed working with are making decisions or not wanting to go down a path that I believe to be right. And I guess the simple thing is you could try banging your head on a wall and or shouting and screaming, but that makes no difference at all, because you rarely persuade anyone to do anything by being difficult, belligerent or sulking. I'm a great believer in understanding why people do things, people say things. There's a great book called Start With Why, if you've ever read it. If you explain why, and you explain it really clearly and almost dispassionately to a point, people tend to go with you, actually. So I guess that's sort of it, really. I haven't jumped up and down or screamed and shouted, but...
Why dispassionately?
Because I think, perhaps that's the wrong word. When I say dispassionately, I mean without an agenda, more than because you can be passionate about something because you care. And I think that's incredibly important if you care about something. But understanding that your view may appear biased and therefore you need to temper it to make sure that the why is unbiased.
I loved your point about belief. I think rather than leading with sustainability in conversations, whether that's with customers or we're speaking into the business, it's actually about meeting people where they are and bringing them on the journey in a less direct way. And to me, that feels like the essence of customer intimacy, staying true to what you believe, but making it land in a way that builds that trust.
One of the things I take away from the conversation we had with Monty was how difficult it is to... We start with our purpose and we know that we want to have a positive impact in some things in the world. And everything we've been talking about today has been evidence of both how authentic that purpose is, but how we believe it's possible to have a positive impact in the world. So we want to have a positive impact in the world. Our economic model, the way we do that in our setting here in BMT, is that we've got a very particular... You know, we're a certain type of business, a technical consultancy fundamentally, and we're in a certain industry or markets. You know, we're not some government agency. We're not an NGO. We're not a social enterprise. You know, we've got our own economic model, and we believe that we can deliver good outcomes in the world from this particular economic model. And I think that's really important here, because And it plays into this customer influence thing, because if we believe we can deliver good outcomes from this kind of business, the business we are, we have to, I guess, seek to be positively influential in the things we do. It won't just happen by, you know, by good luck that if we just turn up every day and sell the things we sell, somehow the world will be a better place. We have to be positively influential. And we had a great conversation with Monty about actually how do you position that influence? Because if you push too hard with the products and services you're selling, then you're ahead of where your customer wants to be and you crash off the front of the wave and your economic model is broken and then you achieve zero. You know, so you have to kind of pace it with your market, and otherwise you don't have the opportunity to have impacts, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. And it's also a judgment call, but it's based on how well you really know your customer and about how much you can help them transform within the constraints that they're having to deal with. So, you know, the classic ones, government with their annualised cycle and real inflexibility about 1 year to the next year. And, you know, the number of times I've heard, oh, next year is going to be even worse. And it never really is. I mean, you know, there's this sort of... But they certainly work in an annualised cycle that's very difficult to break and very difficult to flex. And they want you to innovate. They want you to help them transform an outcome, an output, a product, a service, whatever it is. But they aren't necessarily flush with cash, and they might get to the end of March and the whole thing falls off a cliff edge. And it would be the easiest thing in the world for us as consultants to just take the money and not innovate. And yet we don't do that. And, you know, so I think to Laura's question, you know, what is it about us that means we don't do that? And I think it goes beyond a deep understanding of their problems and the solutions. It actually goes a long way into caring about it, wanting it to be safer, quicker, cheaper, better, more environmentally friendly, better for people's morale, whatever it is, the fact that we care about it. Mm. And I think if I sum up some of the big change programs I've run with four customers in my career, I've been very lucky that I've managed to get away with most of what I've ever tried to do, but probably because I care. And people know you do, you know, that's why I sit as advisors on boards and charities and various bits and bobs, because you're not just there to tick a box and do the governance. You're there because you care about it. And I couldn't work in or lead an organisation I didn't care about. I mean, to me, it's fundamental.
Ultimately, I think we've asked you questions in the past about, we know that you speak often to our customers, but often when they pick up the phone, sustainability isn't front of mind for them. It's not the thing that they're talking about. So how do we get there? We know that there's something they need that they don't have, but it's not front of mind for them right now. We spoke about building intimacy, but are there any levers you think we should be pulling on more to be able to get there?
I'm a great believer in quick wins. If you're running a complex transformation program, or you're trying to take someone on a journey with you, or show you, it's not to tell them the way, but to show them the way, and to give them things that make them feel better about it, so that oh, okay, I get it now, let's go. And you know, when we're working with whoever a customer is, you know, if we're prepared to put sustainability on the agenda, even if it's not something they've asked for, and show them how it can make their life better, why wouldn't we do that? So I think it's that taking that step that, you know, they've asked for this, you're going to deliver that, right? So you're not delivering something that they don't want, but you might be adding something on that really enhances the product or service and experience, and or helps them to even if it's only tick a box with their end customer, whatever it is, but it's giving them a benefit that's tangible.
Yeah.
That they can go, okay, I didn't realise. And some of the work I did
back in the old days, I still wore a lab coat on environmental systems for navies was like that, because none of them were really that interested in environmental compliance. It wasn't a thing. They all had exemptions to MARPOL. It was showing them that there were other benefits, like they could spend longer on tasks in sensitive areas. They didn't have to keep bringing sewage barges alongside, or they didn't have to take the ship alongside. The ship's company was saying that actually this is better because we don't have to deal with the sewage pipe work as frequently. So there was a sort of habitability benefit, there was a drudgery benefit. And it was just sort of stepping back and saying, back to that point about why, what else can this do that might not necessarily be, they don't necessarily, your customer doesn't necessarily care about the thing that you think it's for. What else is sitting around this that actually is valuable to them? And you sell it that way. And you know that it's had a wider benefit, but they've got the little benefit that was important to them.
So I'd say it's a cultural thing as well, and it's being equipped with the knowledge to be able to do that, like our employees are, I guess. It's getting them to recognise that the benefits that they can provide to our customers. I think we spoke about this earlier, that actually we're probably on track. It's not about pulling particular levers. We're on track to creating that culture anyway, if we can make sustainability front of mind, or our employees are looking at how they can benefit their customer through the lens of sustainability, but ultimately it's about improving efficiency.
Yeah.
Then we're ticking the box.
And this is why, and this is something I spoke about on that other podcast I did with Alex Valetti, that sustainability is often thought of as environmental compliance. And yes, it is about that, but it's also about this huge spectrum of other things. And, you know, it annoys me that that's how people think of sustainability. So, you know, if we could, when we talk about embedding sustainability in everything we do, to me, it's about empowering people to realise that this should just be a natural thing, and it's not about ticking a box on environmental compliance. It's about loads of other things as well. And how do we get people to understand that, and to feel like they're sustainability natives, if you like, and that they are then empowered to think about their customer's problem in a different way. Because that's quite, it's also potentially quite a creative process. And, you know, if you can add that to the technical competencies our people have got, it will be really quite exciting, actually.
I think a lot of people, something people probably don't see is, well, Laura and I spend a lot of time talking to the business about sustainability, and people often say, you know, people are supportive and engaged, but we quite often have to put some energy in to activate things. I think people probably don't see that you are one of the voices in the business who's normally in my ear saying, can we go a bit faster, please? And can we do a bit more? And I think that kind of tells the story really nicely of the wider benefit that you're drawing on. With all of that. To move the conversation on, let's go to a third area from our podcast series, the last one we wanted to touch on with you today, which was based on the conversation we had with the EEG.
Yeah, we've touched on this already in part, but it's about how much of our BNT world view should reflect that of our employee world view. We had a number of different perspectives. It was we were really privileged to have that conversation with the EEG, and we found out a lot from them about their perspectives of the network, but shaped around the fact that of the importance of just someone having a voice, no matter what action is taken, that someone's voice has been listened to. I think the other things that we reflected on in that conversation is the challenges of the world at the moment, and the way everything's playing out in geopolitics and everything else. And actually that people feel quite happy to come into work because it's their safe space at the moment. And whilst we
it's easy to perceive us as having lots of different views within the organisation. But as far as they're concerned, we have a set of values. And so that's a safe place for them. They're part of a culture that isn't in sway and in lots of different directions, and their voices can be heard. So that was a really interesting perspective as well. We always talk about how do we have a consistent worldview. And actually, they felt that it was quite consistent, but also that we had the diversity to be able to allow for different perspectives and for people to have a space to share their perspectives.
Yeah. So what would be your view on that, Sarah? You were talking a short while ago about your legacy view, almost, that there's we collectively all hold the organisation in our care for a period of time, and we try and pass it on in good nick for the people who come after, so it can continue to do the things that we think it can fulfil its purpose and do all those good things in the world. And so there's something more enduring in that idea than the tenure of an individual employee. And yet there's also the idea that, as we discussed with the EG, that it's really important to listen to the views of individual employees and then factor those individual views into BMT's overall position on everything. So I don't know if you have any reflections on how that trades off or how they come together, that idea of a longer tenure of a consistency of opinion and values in the business, of position on things and not being blown around by the wind of the day, versus hearing what our employees think and what our customers and other stakeholders think.
Delightful to have such big topics for a Monday lunchtime. Right, so let me start by saying that in spite of all of the stuff about consistency and brand and values and everything else, the world's changing really fast around us. And we are a company and we do have to make money, otherwise we don't survive. So survival is important. It's important actually because it's a vehicle to reward our people to invest in things that matter to us. So the imperative to survive isn't to hand some nameless, faceless shareholder a load of money. It's actually to do some good. And I think that's quite important. It's important to remember that. But it's also important to remember that this organisation operates in the context of its external environment, just as all organisations do. So the idea that somehow nothing would ever change is a nonsense. It has to, otherwise we wouldn't survive. That's the nature of competition. It's the nature of business. It's the nature of economics and commerce and business. But it's also the nature of, you know, sort of Darwinian. It's the nature of evolution. It's the nature of life. So the challenge, I think, for me as a CEO, for executive teams and for all of the other CEOs around the place, is how you take the core elements of your culture, your organisation, your philosophy, your purpose, and make sure that they remain not just fit for purpose, but beyond relevant for the customers and also for your employees as stakeholders in your organisation, and carry on evolving so that you're always ahead of the market and you're always meeting needs. And happily, for the last 8 years, because I've been here 8 years, it's felt like, in spite of a pandemic and a major contract issue in America, that actually we've pulled through all of that and we've held true to our values and our purpose. And I'm very proud of what we've achieved. So there's something enduring about them, which is valuable to me. And I think they'll be match fit to go forwards. But it doesn't mean that what's underneath it won't change, because it has to, because that's just the nature of business, life, the whole thing. And so where it comes to recent tests, I would say, things like the US shift in policy around DE&I in workplaces, and some of our employees through the EEG and directly in conversation with me have their concerns around, this is happening in America. We recognise that the US administration have been writing to companies all over the world saying, we don't like your DE&I policy much, so if you want to carry on doing work with us, you've got to change it. What happens if that sort of pressure is applied to us?
And the simple answer I give is that you don't change your principles because someone else tells you to. A principle is a principle. If it's not, if you think it's a principle, but you're prepared to change it because someone says so, then it's not a principle. You've just called it that. So there's sort of layers to this, I suppose, is where I'm coming from, around if this stuff really matters and it's a principle, it's a value of the organisation, it's not up for debate. It doesn't mean it can't evolve, but you're not going to say, oh, yeah, we're not doing DE&I anymore because the US administration says it's not any good. So we'll bin that and we'll do this instead. You know, we'll go invest in oil rigs or something. You know, I mean, whatever it is, you don't change your principles because somebody else tells you to. And what I, in terms of employee engagement, feedback around that stuff's really important to me. You know, does this... Are we living the values of the organisation? Does this feel right to you? What should we be doing around the edges to make sure that this actually remains not just current but leading this year, next year, 5 years' time? And that to me is partly where the value of employee feedback comes from, because that's where the live reality of it is. You know, I don't sit in an ivory tower. I don't even have an office, let alone a tower. But... you know, I accept that I'm not, you know, I can't be everywhere and I'm not on the front line, and people will have views that are shaped by, you know, the office, their customers, their families, you know, the environments they live in. And I want to hear their thoughts and their feedback, which is why the EEG is so important to me as a vehicle to do that. But it's not the only one. And so, you know, trying to be accessible to people so that they can share their thoughts and ideas is really important.
I think it's really interesting at the moment. You picked up on the DEI in the US, and it's not always easy, as we've discovered through our series of conversations, to know how to apply your principles, because sometimes they end up in conflict with each other.
Yeah.
And I think the US DEI one is a great example, because I can argue really strongly that for a passionate position on DEI, that's, you know, really one we shouldn't move away from. And I can also argue very strongly about respecting a democratically elected government and the institution of democracy and the will of the people, and what happens when those two things clash against each other and we have to pick a side, or a way through it, isn't easy. But then that's what our senior leaders, you know, try and help us as an organisation find a way through. And I guess that's part of the weight that sits on your shoulders, is to provide the view from the bridge through all of these different icebergs that could put a hole in us.
Yeah, and you know, you could say through one lens that BMT, because you know we operate by and large in English speaking parts of the world, but that's kind of where it's you know, in terms of what's happened politically over the past year, 18 months, we're seeing rapid and profound changes. And, you know, our people are living that on the front line all of the time, both in terms of, you know, what they go home to, the news they look at in the evenings or mornings, you know, what their kids are being taught at school and what their government's saying to them. And everyone's going to have their own different view of it. And, you know, if you ask BMT, we find that when we do surveys, how do you find this? You'll get the broad spectrum of views. Because we're reflective of society, so that's life. My job, the executive team's job, the board's job, is to create clarity, essentially, and say this is who we are, this is where we're going. You know, it's not a democracy, but I am interested in everyone's views and genuinely interested, and we change things based on employee feedback all the time. But that point about principles... there are things that maybe as principles to us, the D&I one's a classic one at the moment, where that may well polarise some of our employees' views. That the sort of fact of life, isn't it, really? And, you know, all of us as employees have a choice about whether you feel that your values are aligned to the organisation you're working for. And so to say, well, we've got strong values, we've got a strong purpose, so do most organisations. They live it in different ways. People have a choice about where they work, where they turn up and
what they contribute to the organisation. But that point about feedback is really important, because it doesn't mean every piece of feedback is going to be acted on, because it is polarising sometimes. But collecting it, listening to it and being aware of it is really important, because then when someone raises a concern somewhere, you can think, well, actually, I have heard that somewhere else, or I recognise why that might be an issue. If you're blind to all of that, if you're not listening, how on earth do you know?
It took us into quite an interesting perspective because of the diversity of perspectives and how that's evolving. We spoke about agency and how that's evolving, and how much agency should an employee have to act on something that they believe within BMT. And I think that will evolve over time as the perspectives become more diverse. And out of all of our employees, you probably have the most agency to make a decision or to act. Do you see that evolving, where the decisions you make, it will be harder to reflect the employee perspective because of the diversity of views?
So I think it's absolutely true that the diversity of the organisation will grow over time, and I welcome that. And, you know, there's lots and lots of evidence, proper quantitative evidence, about business performance of organisations that are more diverse versus ones that are less diverse. And it, you know, the more diverse, the more positive the performance tends to be. And so if you embrace that, then you hold the view that that means that you would want to listen to the broadest set of views. But ultimately, many decisions in business, although there can be a huge number of things you have to take into account, you only get to make one decision. And by and large, you know, that's just the responsibility of leadership to have to do that. And you have to, if you're in an environment where anyone can make a decision about anything, nothing ever actually happens. So you've got to, it's that balance of, it's going to make me sound like a fan of hierarchy, but it's not the case at all. You've got to achieve the balance of, at some point, important decisions that have to be made in a timely manner just need to be made. And you can consult on the things that really matter, especially if you know you've got time to do it, and you've still got to go with a consensus view, because you've only got one decision point. So it's yes or no, it's go or don't go, do this or do that. You know, whatever it is, someone's got to make a decision. And, you know, I'm a great believer in delegating and empowering the lowest possible place in the organisation, so that the vast majority of things can just happen without being hampered by leadership. But if it's difficult, you know, I would expect to take some views and then decide. And that has to happen in organisations. Otherwise, you just atrophy. Because everyone would be involved in everything, and there's no, you just can't run an organisation like that.
No, and I think that brings us really nicely back to almost where we started some of the conversation today, which is, you know, there are a lot of big things that we have to think about, and collectively in BMT, our collective endeavour, that this thing we do together, and it's we here, I know it's respected across the business that actually we take a thoughtful view. It's BMT's way. It's that sort of in our DNA, is to take a thoughtful view about complicated things. And I guess that's the essence of the conversations we're having here today, is that none of these things have been black and white. And thank you for being a good sport, Sarah, and taking very, very big questions straight on the chin, where there isn't a right answer. And whichever way we debate these issues, history will probably tell us we got it wrong eventually. At some point in the cycle of human existence, we'll get things right and things wrong. So really appreciate you kind of talking about these really big things, Sarah. And I think it rounds off our first series of podcasts really, really well. We've had so many big topics to talk about. And when you, what do you do when you stop thinking about these things? So as I said earlier, I know you do think about these big questions. How do you turn off from it all? Like when you're done thinking about the nature of humanity, global security, where the next war is going to break out, and then, like, you know, the performance of the last quarter to boot on top of it, where do you go to just let go of all of that stuff?
Well, so to an extent, I don't let go of it. And actually, a lot of that comes back to the fact that I care about it. So things play through my mind all the time. But I'm not, you know, I'm not an automaton. And I do need to sort of switch my brain at least down a bit, even if not off at times. And, yeah, incompetence at cooking tends to be, you know, the thing that I'll spend some time making up a recipe or something. And actually, but generally speaking, that's when my best ideas appear, because in that moment when my mind is distracted on something, I'll think of something else. And
we're almost out of time, but can you give us a recent culinary disaster?
What's the last thing I cooked badly? What do you... No, I tend to be able to recover them, but, you know, without telling people where I've gone wrong on the en route. Bread. I've been making bread lately. That's my... Trying to make German rye bread with caraway seeds in it, which is delicious. Mm. But sadly, I seem to be able to make German rye bricks with caraway seeds in them. So if anyone knows how to make them lightweight and puffer and fluffy versus something that would probably, you know, kill a small child if you threw it hard enough. So, yeah, that would be helpful.
I'm glad that's your plan for it.
Is that your request?
Either how do we make it fluffy or can someone bring us a small child? Brilliant. Sarah, we'll end it there. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. We've really appreciated the conversation. Yeah.
Thanks, both of you.
And thanks to everyone who has listened in to this series of podcasts. We've hugely enjoyed exploring the complex ethical, social and environmental ideas that sit behind some of our actions and decisions as a business. During the series, it's also been really eye-opening to have the chance to go deeper than the usual soundbites and really get into the thoughtful conversations with our people across BMT. We're taking a break now, but we're currently developing ideas for a second series. So if you have a topic you want to propose, or you'd like to join the discussion on the podcast, or even have any feedback on the ideas covered in this series, please do get in touch. Thanks for coming on the journey with us.